We had a question a while back from Omar. This was last week. And he sent $101. So thank you, Omar. That's very generous. And the question is, what do you think of non-whites or off-whites who hold white nationalist or white identitarian beliefs? Keep up the good work. Well, I know such people. I've met such people. I've actually met a person named Omar who fits that description. I know it's not you. But the question is, what do you think of people like that? I think we call these people allies or sympathizers rather than enemies. And the way that you win any battle is you get more and more people fighting with you and fewer people fighting against you. The way that you get fewer people fighting against you is you have people come over to your side or become neutral. And there's absolutely no reason to think that we can't bring some people who are not white over to our side because our cause is just. And especially if we formulate our cause, as I do, as a universal ethno-nationalist, I believe in independent homelands for all peoples on the planet. There's nothing about that that leaves anybody out. And therefore, even non-whites can be sympathetic to that approach. And I think that that's a defensible moral position to take. So I do think that there's a category that we can just say is allies, allies of color, if you want to put it that way. Jim, what are your thoughts on that?
One thing occurred to me too, like maybe they're just a sincere person who realizes that everyone has a right to, feel comfortable in their skin. You might want to screen some of these people. They might be weird masochists with with all kinds of issues. But otherwise, yeah, I mean, the fewer people you have fighting you, yeah, the chances of winning are much better. Otherwise, yeah, or it's a little suspicious, but I mean, if they come to with, if it's consistency, if they're not, well, the blacks should all be put in camps, but then they're just some kind of weird person.
Thomas,
especially if it's a black segment.
Yeah, I would just say that, logically speaking, our in-group, our positive in-group preference need to be stronger than any negative out-group preference, where basically we love our people more than we despise other people. And really, we despise other people due to their conduct. Like if they were just in their own homeland, I wouldn't care. And so, yeah, we shouldn't, it's illogical to shun them. And a lot of them do understand that they are better off in a white society. I know a lot of, off-white or non-whites who are pro-white, ironically. And, they understand that we will want to have our spaces. They can have their spaces. We can work together. There can be some overlap. That's totally chill. Like, a lot of them also, they're more real. They don't have all this like weird baggage about, white guilt or whatever. And two, I'm also perfectly fine with them as long as they understand, and they do understand if they're acting in good faith, is that they cannot be, they cannot at least, shouldn't dominate the top leadership positions. They can maybe be in some leadership positions, but the top ones should always be, generally white people. And generally agree with that because they are acting in good faith. And two, one of the main reasons why we need to, in my opinion, accept them or treat them normally is because other white people will not like it if we shun them. More than, getting off-whites and non-whites on our side, if we are vicious towards them, that will turn off our own people because our own people value magnanimity, justice, being logical. So ironically, we for every, whenever we scorn non-whites who want to join us, we're probably turning off a lot of white people who would otherwise be down with white identity politics.
There was once a 6 or 7 years ago, there was a black girl from Wisconsin who took an interest in me, and she sent me a picture, this drawing that looked like it was from the 60s or 70s, and it was a Klansman in full Klan regalia carrying a black woman in a bikini, and this girl said that she fantasized about like how sore that black woman's pelvis must have been. I'm like, that's a weird person. I wouldn't take that person as an ally. There are some people who are masochistic who want to join the other side. Those are the only types to be suspicious of. But also America first. And the thing about, I've never heard those guys ever talk about white identity. Maybe I'm missing something, confused, because I know, the mainstream media, white nationalist America, they've been nothing but hostile to it. But I don't know any of the main players in there that are Nordic, like none of them. So maybe they're just mislabeled, or maybe they're a white nationalist group that doesn't have any white people in them. I don't know.
Well, one thing that has to be said is Ali Akbar Alexander never would have been anywhere within Republican politics, much less quote unquote white nationalist politics.
We're on the Mayflower, right?
Yeah. Were it not for the fact that it's more important for Republicans to have a basically to be able to point to him and say, see, we're not racist. It's more important for Republicans to indemnify themselves against charges of racism than it is to indemnify themselves against charges of enabling pedophilia. I remember years ago, Matt Gaetz in Florida, he apparently had adopted some Cuban child. And the kid was graduating from high school, and there was some discussion on this on Twitter. What kind of weird relationship is this? And I'm sure there was absolutely nothing weird about it, but it struck me that for a Republican, it is worse to be thought of as a racist than a pedophile. And that's just an indication of what horrible people they are, how weak they are, how appeasing they are, and how we can't allow that kind of thinking to creep anywhere into our movement. Yet, obviously, Ali Akbar Alexander was consorting with people like Nick Fuentes. Because, again, for Nick, it would be useful to be able to point to somebody like that and say, see, we're not racist. Or Nick himself. Nick claiming that he's literally Hispanic, right? A lot of people who are white identitarians, and there were some in the America First crowd, at least at first, still thought it was very useful to have their Hispanic leader so that they could not necessarily deny the racism charge, but just sort of throw sand in people's eyes. Right. I just don't think that we gain from obfuscating on those essential issues.
A word that I never hear anymore, just like transvestite, is token. But when I was coming up, when I was a kid, like it seemed like everyone, no matter their political affiliation, knew what a racial token and tokenism was. And everyone agreed it was crass and insincere. That entire concept of a token has disappeared. It's like, no, we have equity now. We're 13% black. And yeah, bring back the concept of tokenism. I think that would help.
There's even a character on South Park named Token. Token is black. Yeah. Back when South Park was cool.
Yeah.
You know, the anecdote about the woman who was into racial humiliation porn, basically, is actually very interesting, because there is a subsection of blacks who are into racial humiliation porn. And one of the clearest indications that pornography is not a free market, but a psyop, is that I'm pretty sure I haven't actually, honest, swear to God, I haven't actually tested this out, but I would predict that if you go to Pornhub and do a search, you will not find that kind of racial humiliation porn. And if it was just a free market enterprise and they're just trying to, you know, cater to given preferences, you'd think that would be a thing. But I think it's probably the most forbidden and under service, you know, sort of pornographic taste there is out there. And that's really an indication that pornography is more of a psyop than a business, although it's a multi-billion dollar business. But anyway, let's go back to entropy. We have another question here. This is from ABC. Thank you very much. He sends 10 US dollars. Tucker Carlson's net worth is about $370 million. His severance package is around $25 million. He also stated that the open border policies are driven by political reasons, more Democrat votes, not by any white hate and white replacement goals. Not exactly a dissident, is he? Have you ever heard the Hans Christian Andersen story of the princess and the pea? That's the first thing that comes to mind here. Archie writes in with a $3 US dollar donation. Thank you very much. DeSantis signing HR 269 in Israel is like Trump going to Rhodesia to sign the Platinum Plan. That's good. Is DeSantis going to run for president? Would he even have a chance? Well, I have said nice things about Ron DeSantis in the past because he made Disney scream, but his sloppy blowjobs to the Jewish community are disgusting even for politicians. I mean, he goes overboard even for American politicians, and all American politicians are incredibly craven in courting Jewish votes and especially Jewish money. And I just find it disgusting that DeSantis is constantly jetting off to Israel to announce things. And he goes above and beyond what he needs to do to be governor in a state full of superannuated Jewish retirees. So I think there's something sinister and bad about that. It's an extremely bad taste. I don't want it. And beyond that, it's an assault on freedom of speech. And I'm an absolute free speech fanatic. I'm a First Amendment absolutist. And therefore, somebody like DeSantis attacking the First Amendment basically puts him beyond the pale. And isn't it interesting that he's attacking the First Amendment with the applause of the organized Jewish community? We need to have a series at Countercurrents on the Jewish war against freedom of speech. That would actually be a good book, a good thin book. It could be a massive telephone book if you put all the details in, but a nice little book that just outlines how many of the fronts in the attack on the First Amendment are motivated by, funded by, pushed by the organized Jewish community. We've seen this with the gloating of the ADL over Tucker Carlson being fired. These people are not compatible with the functioning of a liberal democracy. Thoughts about that?
For worst week yet, I'm going to be talking about Ron DeSantis and going to Israel to sign it. I did download the bill. I think it's HB 269, and I'm going to read it. Right now, I'm under the impression it doesn't mention Jews at all, but it's pretty clear. Part of it was inspired by one of those guys, the Goyim Defense League, and they'll just broadcast giant, you know, like Klieg lights, anti-Jew Klieg light messages onto buildings and stuff. I think a letter of the law is about not being able to put political messages on buildings that might not endorse those messages and not littering and stuff. But the fact that he goes to Israel signs it suggests that that's what motivates it. So, yeah, I'm going to have to parse that and figure out if it actually mentions, like, you can't criticize Jews, that would be landmark.
What are your thoughts, Thomas?
Yeah, so about the whole Israeli thing, you know, this is your great explanation of how, like, you know, constitutional case law is made up as you go along. Because we don't actually know if it's quote, constitutional or not until the Supreme Court, you know, deals with it. You know, I think it's very likely that this will be, if it isn't shut down on the appellate courts, it will wind up in the Supreme Court. Now, for that, you do need to have a plaintiff. You just can't be a special interest group who says, I don't like this law. And you need to find someone who's willing to basically be a martyr. And if not violate the law, say I have to, you know, I'm refraining from conduct, which I would rather partake in. And I did see one guy, I can't find the message on Telegram right now, but he was saying, I think maybe Zumerwoff posted it earlier. I won't go into detail. I don't need to quote over Bambi. Say, like, this is not, a lot of people are saying this is a defeat for us. He's saying absolutely not. This is actually a victory because, you know, this will backfire eventually. And I would say, yeah, it will have to backfire because even if it doesn't say Jews specifically, everyone knows that this is about targeting, you know, the whole context of it with the trip to Israel. It's shutting down criticism of Jews. And at this point, you know, would it be illegal to, you know, say, put little light stuff on buildings about white people? I don't know. They wouldn't, you know, prosecute them probably. And two, this is a whole novel area of law because it wasn't until recently that the lasers on buildings became a thing. And they became a thing specifically because free speech was being shut down on Twitter, online, and then also in the streets. So, like, you know, all these littering charges, like where it was like, if you put up a flyer, that's vandalism, which is, you know, it's twisting the law. No one, you know, you find random skater stickers or dog gloss signs, that's not prosecuted as vandalism, that's selective prosecution. So they went to lasers, which don't, you know, hurt the building. At best, that's like maybe a property issue where, you know, they can be asked to stop and they don't stop, then it's disturbing the peace. If we're really, really going to, even then, I think that's stretching the law pretty far, but to make it like a felony, that's ridiculous. And I think that this will blow up in their face. But in the meantime, they will have to forego a lot of free speech. But yeah, it sounds like at least when I saw on Telegram, we have at least one eager plaintiff willing to be the martyr and go to court over this. And he may not have the money for an attorney. It doesn't matter because this is about power, not money. And honestly, lawyers are stupid. A lot of what they do is pee-pee poo-poo. And if you research it yourself, I'm not saying you should go on and do this. There's a lot of nuance you need. But like if he, pro per, wanted to go up, he might be able to do it. And, you know, this is the thing. I think it is a victory because it shows that the Jews and their puppets like DeSantis are so desperate that they're willing to risk a huge landmark Supreme Court case against them to momentarily have a momentary chance to shut down free speech. And two, this will also galvanize the normies to like us more because they're seeing that we're being shut down just like them. At some point, you know, jailing Trump puts them in the same basket as the Charlottesville defendants. You know, censoring us puts us in the same basket as normies want to speak out about vaccine stuff or whatever. So, you know, this will be very, very bad in the short term, but long term, I think we will triumph. And two, DeSantis has totally tanked his chance of winning because he has alienated himself from the MAGA populists and also from the dissident right. So he's doomed. He's just a controlled stooge at this point.
Regarding the Supreme Court, at last count, there are two Jews on the Supreme Court. There used to be three and one died, right? But aren't there like five or six Catholics?
Yeah, that's the thing. There's a lot of like these. So here's the thing. Part of why Jews are in law is because they are subversive, but two, it's because they're trained from a young age in the Talmud, which teaches critical thinking, ironically, where it's like it's Talmudic logic. It's all about, you know, hair splitting, all this. Well, Catholics have something similar where it's less, a whole lot less subversive, where it's theology. Law theology and stuff, you know, unlike Protestants, is kind of like make stuff up, like wild heresies about dinosaur bones being fake and meant to test the faithful and all this televangelist nonsense. Catholics actually, over the centuries, created doctrine. So it is a real religion. It's not just like heretical ramblings. I say it as a pagan. Like Catholics have their stuff down. You know, they're taught at these Catholic schools how to do that. So, you know, basically, Jews and Catholics had a leg up on understanding law because they were, you know, they learned other ways about how to think like a lawyer. But two, it is a problem that a lot of them also were Irish, and that was a thing where they kind of had that pro-immigrant thing. But it's true. It's like a lot of Catholics are on the Supreme Court, and I don't think there's a Catholic conspiracy theory, but, you know, a lot of these, you know, the top law schools that aren't, you know, secular are Catholic. And I think it's a problem where I think mainstream Protestant Anglo-America has to step up is that they need to get more tribal. They need to start having a culture, and that's easier said than done, but hopefully one day.
I think there's one WASP on the Supreme Court now.
Yeah.
In the alleged WASPocracy of America. Right. It's kind of fascinating. So we have other questions here. I have a question from Eric. Thank you, Eric. He wants our thoughts on medically assisted suicide. Jim, let's begin with you.
Oh, Lord. Medically assisted. Well, I'm not even sure where to start with that. Suicide, okay, instead of capital punishment. Because it's running wild up in Canada, right? They're expanding their laws. What is it? Medically assisted induced death or something? It's called, the acronym is MAID. And then, like, people that are, they don't even need medical problems. They can just say they're depressed and get medically. It seems so totalitarian, but I think the problem I have is with the government assistance. If you want to kill yourself, there are plenty of ways of doing it. I don't like getting the government involved in it at all. And that's about as far as I can extemporize on that right now, I think. I mean, if you make it easier for people to kill themselves, I think that's, you know, that serves some agendas, but it makes me queasy, the thought of it.
Yeah, I agree. I think that anybody can kill himself. We know this. You just have to have the guts to do it. Screw up the courage and do it. A lot of people don't do it because their will fails. And maybe that's not a bad thing. Maybe it's good that these people muddle through and get on with life. I'm sure there are many people who contemplated suicide and got over the crisis that they were in and are glad that they didn't go through with it. And now we have people talking about how to make it easy for people to commit suicide. And I think that we'll very quickly go from medical assistance to medical coercion.
Right. I don't think they should have the right to assist or prevent anyone from killing themselves.
I do, as sort of a, on how to put it, on paternalistic grounds, which I do believe in, a little bit of paternalism. If somebody's acting a little nutty and they're up on the bridge and they're about to jump and it doesn't endanger the police or somebody to stop them or catch them with the butterfly net or whatever, I think that that's not a bad thing, because sometimes if they're allowed to dry out or calm down, they'll be glad that they were prevented from throwing their life away in a funk or a peak. Of course, if they're really bound and determined to do it, then they'll be able to do it anyway. But having a little bit of paternalism where the state will step in if you're trying to off yourself, especially in a kind of public way, often that's the cry for help, the quote unquote cry for help.
Yeah, if they're doing it publicly, then that's a different matter.
Yeah. You know, if the police break down the hotel room door to stop you from taking your overdose of sleeping pills, maybe that's going too far. But I can imagine the suicide doctor, and what kind of doctor would specialize in that? What kind of ghoul? You know, I think of Jack Kevorkian. You know, they show up and the person says, well, you know, I've chickened out. I can imagine them just coercing people, bullying them, putting them under pressure.
Especially
I came across town to kill you and you're just, you know, seriously, I can imagine something like that. And
especially
that,
if there's a profit motive.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there's already centers and everything. Yeah.
There's already a lot of coercion with like crazy moms who probably have borderline personality disorder trying to like coerce their kids into like transgenderism. So I could easily see undue coercion. And two, one, it's just very subversive because, yeah, a lot of old people, they waste a huge amount of money in their final months when they're probably better off just, you know, going quietly one way or another. But the commercial in Canada for this suicide service was all white people. When was the last time you saw a commercial with even a majority of white people that like, you know, an interracial couple or something? That's unheard of in 2023. And that should tell us their intentions perfectly well. They just want to accelerate the deaths of despair. And personally, for me, I think it's also cowardice if you can't do it yourself. Like, if I ever got terminal cancer, I'm not going to have everybody like be going boo-hoo. I'm going to go find a nice trench in Ukraine, and I will die heroically.
Yeah, there's nothing to prevent people who have the guts to follow through from killing themselves. And there's every reason to think that society is not going to be improved by making it easy for weak and waffling people to kill themselves.
Oh, fun fact.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and Chambers, the King in Yellow, the main story of the collection of short stories, and the main story is called The Repairer of Reputations. And he wrote it, I believe, in 1895, and set in a science fiction alternate 1920s. And one of the things, and we're not sure if this is actually true or not, because the main character is crazy. It's obviously he's crazy. He's an unreliable narrator. But one of the things they have is assisted suicide chambers. And the story involves the opening of one of the first ones, actually. So I think it's very eerie that they're doing this thing that was considered like a dystopian science fiction thing from a previous century.
Yeah, well, it sounds like Soylent Green,
too. That's what I was going to bring up. Yeah, when I was 9 or 10, I thought that was such a cool movie. But the scene with Edward G. Robinson when he goes to the suicide clinic is harrowing and hard to watch, especially because Edward G. Robinson died a couple months after filming that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's creepy. And to make it easy, I think is ghoulish. And I, just as I question the motives of people who want us to eat bugs, and I question the motives of people who talk about gender-affirming care for kids, I question the motives of people who want to make suicide easier. There are ghouls in this world. Now, I don't want to talk about demons because that sounds too much like pandering to boobs, but there are evil, twisted people. And a lot of what the left does is simply enabling evil, twisted people to get their jollies. The eat the bug stuff is sadism. The gender affirming care stuff is Frankenstein like ghoulishness and sadism. And the physician assisted suicide is ghoulish. And we ought to, if we're going to question anybody's motives, let's question the motives of these people. What kind of people make this a crusade? What kind of person was Jack Kevorkian? By all accounts, he was a sinister ghoul. And I think that people like that look for crusades, and they look for virtue that they can cloak their ghoulishness in, which is a theme in Jim's writing. They look for virtuous ways to cloak their evil motives. People do this all the time. And I think that we need to be very, very skeptical of these crusades, these progressive crusades to make death and mutilation easier.
I have a Jack of Orkian story that's ghoulish, but not exactly in that way. When he was all over the news in the early 90s, someone gave us his private number in Royal Oak, Michigan. My wife at the time, Debbie, called him. We recorded it. She said she had ovarian cancer. How do I kill myself? Judging from his tone during this, he didn't seem like he was getting off on it. He just said, well, okay, don't panic. Panic's the worst thing you can do. Just send me your records. We'll look into it. I can't guarantee it. He seemed kind of rational. The ghoulish element of that story is 4 years later, she got ovarian cancer and died.
Yeah, that's very worrying. I've always feared malingering, saying, I'm sorry, I can't come to the picnic, I'm sick. Because I have such a strong imagination that if I pretending that I'm sick, I fear that I'll actually make myself sick. And so I just don't do stuff like that. And maybe that's just kooky, but I always have had this fear that I can believe myself into, put it this way, that my imagination is powerful enough that I will get psychosomatically ill if I go down the path of saying, I'm sorry, I'm sick. I've got to opt out of something like that. So, but that is really quite a chilling story. Folks, if you have more questions and comments, now is the time. ABC has written in with $10 again. Thank you very much. Jordan Peterson was asked in an interview with Piers Morgan whether AI represents the greatest danger to civilization. He answered that he would consider narcissistic compassion as the greatest danger. Could you elaborate on that? Well, that's interesting. I didn't see that. But let's set aside AI for a minute and talk about narcissistic compassion. What is he talking about? He's talking about virtue signaling, basically. And I think that, yes, virtue signaling is an extremely dangerous thing. Why? Well, because it's basically turning morality into a weapon. It's weaponizing morality and turning it into a way of extracting status. And when that gets into a kind of spiraling competition, like a virtue race, right? It's not an art, like an arms race, only with fake virtue signaling, you can get societies that simply go off the cliff. They immolate themselves in orgies of moral panics and virtue signaling. All this horseshit about George Floyd. I still just cringe when I see this now in academic books that have been published, where the author will try and work in something about the murder of George Floyd. Like this is the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. It's a breaking point in history, right? I just think that's all bullshit. What percentage of these people actually believe that he was murdered? That it was actually a big thing? That it was a world historical event? I don't know. A lot of these people don't even know. You couldn't even get them to introspect long enough. But what we had there is just an orgy of competitive virtue signaling to the point where they were erecting hideous statues of this disgusting drug addict who OD'd, right? I think that is an extremely dangerous thing. You can get entire civilizations immolating themselves. How many people died? How many cities burned? How many people lost their livelihoods because of competitive virtue signaling about a felon who died of a drug overdose? So I do think it's a grave danger. What are your thoughts on this, Jim?
Jim, okay. Well, I mean, I don't think, unless they invent a machine where you can actually measure ethics, this is just a hunch of mine. I've been around for more than six decades, and my observations, it's almost like I could probably try to come up with a mathematical equation for it. The more someone virtue signals, the less virtuous they are in practice. The finest people I've met never, ever feel the need to blow their virtue trumpet. I suspect that virtue signaling is a sign of insecurity. It's like, I'm not a fag. It's like, well, we're at the dentist. Why did you bring that up? It's like, why do you need to shout it from the rooftops? Nobody even asked you. In practice, what I've seen is like the really, truly ethical people who are helpful, they don't harm, they don't backstab, they never need to make a point of it. So maybe like an accomplished Swiss psychiatrist or psychologist can come up with a syndrome for that. It should be classified. I mean, as much as I don't really believe in these designations of mental illness, I think virtue signaling is a sign of some sort of insecurity or psychological disorder.
But my two cents. So we talk a lot about how the 13 black to 50 crime, how there's 2% of Jews running stuff. Well, the other percent might need to start worrying about is the 6%. So in his book, Political Ponderology, Lobachevsky, and I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, he was a Polish man. He observed that about in a society, there's about 6% of people who are totally psychopathic, who will do whatever it is that they need to do to get power. These are overrepresented in law, military, other fields. He observed this in communist Poland, and he said, like, these people just went along with the party for power. You know, these people would be card-carrying NSDAP members. If they were in Germany during a certain time period, they were card-carrying commie members during that time period. And if they were here in America today, they'd be, like, full-on. Your Instagram would be BLM nonsense nonstop. And so, yeah, we really need to watch out for this. And this is a problem that, well, we can deal with the blacks, we can deal with Jews, but there will always be 6% of the population lingering as a fifth column unless we somehow practice eugenics and get rid of those genes. And there's a lot of danger in getting rid of genes because sometimes they're useful in small amounts. But they're always going to be there lurking in the background. A lot of this, it comes down to it's, they can't be trusted. And, you know, a lot of these people, it's very effeminate. They're out of control. There's all crossover dark triad traits. And I think going forward, if America ever recovers from this, we're going to have like a zero tolerance policy on guilt tripping. And the moment that anybody guilt trips, they're just completely shunned as it should be considered. It is a logical fallacy, and it should be considered. We should basically sub out the slippery slope from being a logical fallacy, because it's not, it's how nature works, and plug in, you know, narcissistic compassion.
I think that's well said. There's one profession where sociopathy or psychopathy is actually socially useful, and that's surgeons. Surgeons are disproportionately sociopathic, and it serves them well because their level of empathy is sufficiently low that they can just slice and dice human bodies without getting emotional over it. Of course, the very same people would make wonderful torturers under a different regime, but that is the one socially useful profession that seems to attract sociopathic people disproportionately. I thought that was really quite interesting.
Greg, have you ever seen the 1971 film The Hospital with George C. Scott, screenplay?
Absolutely.
Patty Chayefsky.
Yeah.
Now, I didn't catch it or not. I watched it the other night for the first time. I remember seeing it on the Oscars and thinking, that's a weird looking movie. But the Barnard Hughes character, who's Diana Rigg's father, who's killing all these people in the hospital. Was he a surgeon or was he just a religious nut? I'm not sure.
He was a religious nut. He was brought into the hospital and they basically almost killed him through incompetence.
Okay. So he was just getting revenge. Okay.
And so he was just getting revenge. Yeah. But he was like a complete religious nut. But yeah, that is an absolutely brilliant movie, by the way. And I highly recommend it. It was written by the same guy who wrote Network, which I think is one of the great screenplays.
Then 10 years after he wrote The Hospital, he got cancer, but he was so afraid that the surgeons would, he died of cancer a year later, but he didn't want to get surgery because he thought the doctors would be pissed off at him for writing that screenplay.
That's highly neurotic of the guy, poor guy. He shouldn't have done that. So let's see if we have more questions here.
I saw a comment, follow up on Chavez, from Simons too. They said that every BPD woman has like their transgender kid. And I saw a stat recently where every transgender kid I don't have the exact stat, but it's like 75% of them had mothers who either had BPD or depression or took depressive meds. So it's totally true. Like, this is a completely concocted thing created by out of mental illness, predominantly by virtue signaling women.
Yeah, that's truly, truly horrifying. Munchausen by proxy is one of these mental illnesses that's almost exclusively a female thing. And I do think that a lot of Munchausen moms, this is something that Kievsky suggested a couple years back, Munchausen moms are pushing the transsexual stuff on their kids, and then virtue signaling about how progressive and open they are at helping their kids deal with this. It's truly frightening. Definitely a huge problem. We have to be mistrustful of the motives of these people who cloak themselves in these virtue campaigns. And the whole tranny thing, the idea that transsexuals, that we must measure society by how it enables transsexuals is true insanity. We really have to push back at that. So there is a comment here at Entropy. Let me just find it. We have some really good comments going here. So let me just scroll back and find it. Michael sends in $1 and says, in Futurama, the robot Bender meets the protagonist Fry at a coin-operated suicide booth. I did not know that. I haven't watched that, but that's thank you for that. So there was another person who in Entropy said that he's brought a lot of people over to our side just by being approachable. And this is true. It's easier to attract flies with honey than vinegar, is the old saying. Just being approachable, affable, and giving off the vibe that you're willing to listen to politically incorrect ideas is often enough to get people to open up, and then you can start bringing people over. It is an important fact.
Yeah, I saw that Dorian Stop the Steal. I was running around a lot with Culture War criminal, also known as Ryan Sanchez, and like we both noticed that like there might be some initial kind of standoffishness, but like once they usually evaporate pretty quickly because we're out there with them, and you know we are listening to their stuff. And if we were like side a little when occasionally heard stuff about QAnon, we're like, oh Lord. But like the mere fact that we are willing to listen to them and not shut them down, you know, that's how humans treat each other. And I really think that you know in society we don't act like humans anymore. It's like it's always this weird artificial shut it down nonsense, you know, you're the enemy. And I know it sounds like kind of like mushy, touchy-feely stuff, but it's like, can't we just be humans and like talk to each other? Like the left needs to be shut down because what they're peddling right now is like pure evil. But on the right, I welcome free debate with anyone on the right, as long as they're acting in good faith. And if they're acting in bad faith, I almost welcome it still because I can just like, if we have an honest debate, they'll just be shut down and they'll be wiped like they'll be mopped like the floor.
There are a number of very good comments here that I just want to riff off of. Horatius, who is the person who mentioned being approachable and bringing people over earlier, thank you. He mentions that Uncle Ted Kaczynski, has great analysis of the libshit. I do think that industrial civilization and its future, I believe that's the name of his manifesto, has a really profound analysis of the psychology of the left, the over-socialized, devitalized left. I do think that that's quite impressive. And it's implicitly vitalist and implicitly Nietzschean. I actually wrote him a letter years and years ago, more than 20 years ago, asking him if he had been influenced by Nietzsche. There was also something in there that sounded a little bit maybe like Ayn Rand. And so I asked about her, and he wrote back, and he was a little bit testy with me because he resented the assumption that in my letter that he was the author of the manifesto. He was still trying to tap dance around that issue. But he said no, that he hadn't had any real philosophy, and he had heard of Nietzsche, and I think he had heard of Ayn Rand. But he was just sort of basing it on an understanding of psychology. And I do think that there's a lot that's really quite profound. Rich Hauck and I did a live stream a couple of years ago about Uncle Ted that I think is worth visiting if you're interested in his thought. Geist, do you have any thoughts on Ted Kaczynski?
I think I quoted part of Industrial Society and its Future in the Redneck Manifesto, there's a whole segment called The Psychology of Leftism, and it's about how they say they're motivated by compassion, but hostility is too prominent a facet of their behavior for that to be remotely true, so is the drive for control. He also said something about how, you know, if they say they're anti-racist, they'd be a lot less hostile toward white people. And he talks about them laying in front of tanks, and like the masochism was also, it's still, I think, the most clinical dissection of leftist psychology I've ever seen.
Thomas, what are your thoughts?
So I have to admit, I haven't read Ted's book, unfortunately, but I do agree that the Industrial Revolution was pretty awful, mainly in regards to the dysgenic effects, where I think Mr. Dutton covers that with the spiteful mutant phenomenon. Like, well, all these people that we deal with today wouldn't even exist in a pre-industrial society, because along the road, they and their ancestors wouldn't have produced. There's about generally 50% mortality rate, which is terrifying. I'm not saying we should go, you know, I'm not sure how to deal with this problem ethically. I think we might need to just ask people in the future not to reproduce, do genetic screening, or maybe reproduce less, like maybe have one kid instead of like two or three. But I mean, I think part of the reason why the Anglosphere is so messed up is because they industrialized first. So they had these terrible mutations first. And at some point, like once you take that pressure away, you know, we need that pressure to just stay stable. Without it, we're going to go to the left to become mutants. A lot of these people, I don't want to sound crasher, but they do look like mutants. Like they don't look healthy at all. It's not just due to the seed oils, even though that certainly doesn't help either. So I definitely agree with that. I'm very much a fan of, you know, industry and nature should coexist. And two, I do think technology leads inherently to this reign of quantity versus like how much crap can you mass produce? How many Sherman tanks can you produce so you can arm the Soviet Union to destroy Europe instead of quality? And eventually we're going to have to come to terms with this and somehow, you know, find a way to live with technology where we control it doesn't control us.
That's a tall order. I'm not sure that technology is avoidable.
Yeah, I would say if we try to avoid it, it's going to backfire, because if we avoid it, other people will not, and then they'll conquer
us. Right, that's
what
I mean, right.
Yeah, but we have to, like, it's an issue we have to confront head on and find some way where, I don't know if there's, like, a strong government that regulates it, or if we have to have some type of, like, spiritual reawakening where we understand that, you know, the human part has, we have to be in control somehow, or at least be equal to it, not just let it take us away to, like, mass production and quantity. I think maybe a point that's being brought up with AI is that AI has no inherent creativity. It's just a reflection of us. So for all its computing power, for all its all the cool stuff it can do, it's still us. It needs us more than we need it.
I wonder if you asked a robot if they'd feel the same way. I'm not sure.
I have a few questions here. Gaddius writes in with $10. Thank you very much. At the end of Tucker's video, he says, true things will prevail. It seems to me, though, that most people aren't concerned about facts. They seem to be persuaded by stories and narratives rather than cold, hard facts. When does constructing a narrative turn into lying, in your opinion? That's a really good question. My sense is that it turns into lying when you start either dropping facts out or making facts up. And there's a real strong pressure to do that when you're constructing a narrative. You try and make things fit the narrative. So yeah, I think that is a temptation that you've got to resist. And usually you can pretty much get our agenda and all the facts together at the same time. And therefore, when people take shortcuts by, you know, overlooking things or making stuff up, it's just counterproductive anyway. Yeah, you get your hot take out 5 seconds sooner, perhaps, but it's shot down 5 seconds after that. Whereas if you just paused and waited a little bit and let the nuances sort of sink in, you can square our outlook with the facts anyway. What are your thoughts on this, Jim? I know it's a pet peeve of yours.
I think, yeah, I sense that question was for me, Gaddius. But good Lord, this is going to be me at my most superstitious sounding, but I think truth, I mean, quantifiable truth is as close as I believe in God. And the reason I'm not a Christian is I don't think it makes any sense. Now, I know as much as EMJ talks about logos and the word, and I may be wrong about this. I think it has its roots in it's related to the word logic, that logos, people started believing in something when two plus two always equals four. I think if you want to construct a narrative, you're going to persuade a lot of emotional morons, but maybe the problem isn't that, you know, you need to lie. The problem is there's too many emotional morons. And if we're going to practice eugenics, let's get rid of the emotional, moronic people. I think sooner or later, the narrative will fall apart. And I'm still angry my parents lied to me about Santa Claus. Maybe I should get over it, but that's what I try to pursue, is what's actually true. And again, this is, our perception is incredibly limited, just like our, you know, the bandwidth of light. We're only able to see a tiny sliver of that bandwidth. I think truth will out. I think Tucker was right about that. I'm not sure. I mean, humans are intensely flawed. Maybe evolution will take us somewhere, maybe assisted by robots. Maybe they'll find the part of the brain that's so illogical and it's just ruled by emotion and zap that. I'm not sure. But Gaddius knows. I know Gaddius is a narrative guy. I'm a truth guy. Truth is as far as we're able to comprehend it.
What do you?
The reason I'm not a Christian is it's not logical. Whatever there is doesn't make me an atheist by any. I think there's something out there. I think we're just too dumb to grasp it. But I think we should try to grasp it to the best of our ability.
So I'm going to be a legal nerd for a sec. And I think you pass from creating a narrative, which in my opinion is just like doing analysis. It's not a narrative. It's simply adding analysis. So you're not just spitting facts. There's a takeaway. It becomes lying when you make what I would call a material omission, which is when you leave out facts that a reasonable, ordinary person would like to know, which would either would at least influence their decision, or they at least would like to be appraised of, even if they don't change their decision. And so the left might say, like, well, when we say 13 black to 50 crime, the left might say, well, you're admitting that some blacks don't do crime, and you know there are bad people everywhere. Some white people are criminals too. I say, no, it's not a. We're not spinning a narrative out of that, because, you know, that's not, you know, people kind of, it's already there in the stat. And to an ordinary, if someone's reasonable, they would understand that, you know, okay, there's a black scholar out there. There's also a white criminal. That doesn't change the fundamental truth here. And my other point I'd like to make is that for me, I don't really have an ideology. I think instead of having an ideology, like a party program, should be more of a vibe or an aesthetic based upon truth, life, excellence. And then just let the facts, the whatever details we need, make them up, if really make them up as we go along as the situation demands. Like, our ideology should be truth in life.
Yeah, that's very well put. I think that's a very good contribution. I really do think that we should always cleave to the truth, because ultimately it's objective and real. And narratives that stray from the truth are found out, and we lose our credibility. it's the left who are the people who push narratives at the expense of fact. And we should be the ones who always guard our credibility. Now, the reason why the left does this is that they have so much power. They have this power. And it's interesting, you see these old school politicians, these fossils like Joe Biden or Hillary Clinton, lie. They lie all the time. And why do they lie all the time? Well, they live, they have fossilized old brains, and they are still living in the world where there were three TV networks and NPR and all that kind of stuff. And they had people who would cover for their lies all the time. There weren't alternative media out there that could unravel these lies very, very quickly. And we have made a huge leap forward for all the problems that we face. Social media and alternative media make it harder for these people to get away with lies. And it's really funny when you see these old political fossils who are living in the past just lying blatantly because they came from a time when they could do this and they were never held accountable. So I think that truth is on our side. And although their media isn't on our side, there's enough alternative media to get the truth out. So I think it's very, very foolish for us to go with spin and narrative, because it's super easy for that to be unraveled as well. And then we lose our credibility. They have all the money in the world. They have all the institutions in the world. We have nothing but the truth on our side and the credibility that we gain from cleaving to it and speaking it fearlessly. And that's where we have to stay, and we can't afford to cut corners on that. So I have a question here on Telegram. So a friend writes in, is there a need for the creation of a transversal movement that does not leave the most racially conscious leftist voters without a political choice? I'm not sure what's meant by transversal. However, I do think it's important for us to gain pro-white ideological hegemony in society. And what does that mean? Well, I have an article called Hegemony where I talk about this. We need to find a way of ensuring that there's a vast array of choices in a pluralistic society that are all palatable to white people. Just like today, under Jewish hegemony, we have a wide array of choices that are all Jewish approved. They're all kosher. You can have anything you want as long as it's kosher. You can have Ron DeSantis, or you can have Joe Biden. As long as it's kosher, you are given a choice, or an illusion of choice. In no serious society are you allowed to basically choose social nihilism, right? No serious society permits that. We live in a society that's anti-white and pro-Jewish, basically. If we had a serious white society, we would take the anti-white options off the table. Anti-whiteness and the people who push it would simply not have a voice. They would not be able to frame options. They would not be able to have access to media power, political power, etc. They would be as toxic and radioactive and shunned as pedophiles once were. And still are to some extent. That's the future that I would like to have. I'd like to have a pluralistic society where we take the anti-white stuff off the table and establish that kind of ideological hegemony. How do we do that? Well, we colonize every aspect of the culture with our pro-white viewpoint. And that means that we're going to have pro-white leftist viewpoints too. We know that we'll be winning when the Communist Party is as pro-white as the center-right party or the far-right party. There's a wonderful video that I saw a few years ago. I think it's been taken down from YouTube. It was a French channel on YouTube, a French dissident channel. And this French journalist interviewed the leader of the Hungarian Marxist-Leninist Party, the Magyar Munkás Párt, I think is what it's called, the Hungarian Workers' Party. And anyway, he's sitting in his office and, you know, there are red volumes of like the collected works of Lenin on the shelf behind him in Hungarian, something like that. That's how I remember it. And he's asked why the Orthodox Marxist-Leninist Party of Hungary opposed migrants in the 2015 migrant crisis, why they backed Viktor Orban. And the leader of the Marxist-Leninist Party said, well, these migrants would come in and they'd take jobs and benefits away from Hungarians, and those are the primary concern. And besides, Hungary has a terrible diversity problem with gypsies, and the last thing they need to do is add more diversity to the country. And I watched this and I thought, I told Jared Taylor about this, and Jared's comment was, this is Marxism we can live with, right? But that's a sign of basically hegemonic, sensible values in a society. If you can have the Orthodox Marxist-Leninist Party and the rightist parties on the same page about something existentially crucial, like keeping control of the borders and not exacerbating diversity and not allowing the great replacement, then you've won, right? And it doesn't matter what party is in office. And the parties can change, exchange power back and forth. And the most important things are not threatened. That's what we need to have. We need to have that kind of hegemony. And that means that there will be a racially conscious left in the future as well. So if that's what you're thinking about, my answer is yeah, basically there should be a racially conscious left. And there was a racially conscious left. And if you look at people like, for instance, Jack London, Jack London was a racially conscious leftist. So why don't we go to Jim? Jim, do you have any thoughts on this?
I don't hear anything I can disagree with. I mean, from one angle, Karl Marx was Jewish and, you know, the Bolsheviks were hostile toward Russian tradition and ethnic Russians. Okay. But you can take Marxism just as an economic theory, and it has nothing to do with race. Yeah, and maybe you would need a hegemony to get to that point. But I think people do they go down the left-right rabbit hole far too much. And I've said that the only issue is white survival. I mean, biological survival. There's clearly an attack on that. I think left and right are largely distractions. When I interviewed Tom Metzger back in 89, he just said that it's, you know, left and right are two arms on the same monster, essentially. At least at that point it was. So yeah, I mean, I like whiteness is really the only, you know, for me and my son, that's all I care about. What someone thinks otherwise or policy, I think runaway capitalism is abusive just as runaway communism is. So yeah, everything else gets in the way of the main issue, which is biological survival. But you know, biology is something you can prove that you're white. You can examine a corpse and prove that it had ancestors in Europe. You can't prove whether that skull that you're testing was a communist or a fascist.
Yeah, once the blue hair has disappeared, you just can't tell. Thomas, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, so I know the left and right are usually spoken of in economic terms, but for me, left has to do with disillusion and corrosion. The right has to do with order and tradition. So a pro-white communist to me is actually right-wing because they have a higher point of reference. They're trying to build something up, not tear it down. So they're a very strange right-winger. They're unusual, but they're still right-wing, actually, for my little paradigm that I work in. I'd welcome a debate with them. I think that'd be odd, but it's interesting to say the least. And two, it's you know, that's actually not destructive. The left to me is pure destruction. That's trying to build something, maybe in an odd manner, but I can really respect that, actually.
It's what I think you ask an average leftist. They think they're trying to build a just society. Maybe the political division should be constructionists versus deconstructionists.
Yeah. I think, too, you know, and too, it's like the whole environmental thing. Like, for me, that's called a left-wing thing. It should be right-wing because they're trying to conserve something, unlike conservatives who conserve nothing, not the environment, not even their pocketbook that they're so obsessed with. So in my opinion, we should, some of these left-wing things like, you know, health, or you know, regulating food so it's healthy and tastes good, like in Europe, unlike the Zog McDonald's trash in America. That might sound smack of leftism. That might be something to hear from a campus liberal from previous decades, but in my opinion, that's actually very right-wing. Same with, you know, the environment, and, you know, I'll go there. Like, people have said that nationalism and socialism coexisted once. Well, maybe can again. I mean,
there is a dynamic in capitalism of competitive cost cutting that leads to the decline of standards. There's no question about that. This is especially the case in the entertainment industry. And we just lost Jerry Springer, one of the great pioneers of pulling the plug on any kind of standards and just seeing how low television could go. And of course, he had lots of people who were willing to watch it because it was increasingly lurid and sort of quasi-pornographic. It was not pornographic, but obscene. Obscene is what shouldn't be seen, what you shouldn't look at. And there's a lot of stuff in popular culture that's obscene now. And the reason why it's out there is that it's highly profitable once people's standards have been so debased that they're willing to consume it. And so there's a cultural logic of capitalism that leads competitively to the debasement of standards, standards of behavior, standards of taste. And this is something that needs to be shored up by anti-competitive, anti-capitalist standards. And those have to come from somewhere outside the marketplace. So I agree that we simply can't be free market capitalists. And none of us are. None of us really are. And we had this very good conversation about that with Morgoth and Pax Populi a couple months back, where we were just talking about why is it that there are people within our movement who are fighting about capitalism versus socialism when we're neither capitalists nor socialists, we're some kind of third position. I have another question here that's pretty good. This comes from Reed Johnson, who's a valued contributor, a valued moderator. Do prominent media figures make for good politicians? Have they ever? And if not, why? That's a really interesting question. And while Thomas and Jim are thinking about it, I will say a few things because I've been thinking about it because I saw it first. I can think of an example of a prominent media figure who was a pretty good politician, and that was Ronald Reagan. Now, yes, okay, Ronald Reagan had a lot of bad policies, and we look back on it and we think how naive, and we wish that older people would break out of their Reagan worship and realize that, no, things are getting worse and worse. Reagan, of course, gave us this amnesty that was just a terrible decision, but was, in a very technical sense, a great political communicator and leader, precisely because of his experience in the media. Because so much of politics is communication, people who are very good at communication, I think, can make the leap into the political realm. Reagan, I think, you know, we give the conservatives a hard time and say they don't conserve anything. The truth is that the things that post-World War II conservatives cared about, they actually won on. Think about National Review. Think about the synthesis that National Review brought together. They were a synthesis of free market economics and anti-communism and a sprinkling of social conservatism. Now, the social conservative stuff has all been allowed to slide, and that's because it was never the most important thing to these people. The most important stuff was the economic stuff and the Cold War stuff, and they won. They won on economics. By the time Bill Clinton came along, you know, the neoliberal consensus came along, basically the center left had jettisoned socialism as a model, and they had made their peace with capitalism. Yeah, capitalism with lots of controls and thumb on the scale for blacks and other groups like that, but capitalism. Okay, they won on that, and under Reagan, And then under the George W. Bush administration, they won the Cold War. They won the Cold War and brought down communism. The things that were important to them, they were actually good at winning at. They unfortunately didn't regard demographics as important. And a friend of mine said, you know, was involved in Republican politics for decades, you know, a racialist, but he was watching Republican politics for decades and was somewhat marginally involved in it. And he said, for decades, the Republican talking points were about the Great Replacement and demographic decline. Don't worry, it's never going to happen. And then sometime, I think in the 1990s, it switched overnight to, it's too late, there's nothing we can do about it. You know, the common denominator is do nothing, right? They just didn't care about it, right? So yeah, conservatives can win the things that they care about. And I think Reagan was actually really a very effective political leader, conservative political leader. Unfortunately, he didn't care about the stuff that we care about. And so his legacy has been marred by that. And in long term, America will fail because of the, you know, the replacement of the white population. But he's an example of a media figure who transitioned into politics and was very successful, certainly measured by his own ambitions. Jim, can you think of examples of media figures who've been good politicians?
I think you answered it with Reagan and Trump, but today I'm the master of dwelling on the previous topic.
Okay.
And I have it, of course, I have a Jerry Springer story.
Oh, please.
Was not mentioned in your favorite all-time book, Shit Magnet, but when I was involved in this really sick relationship with a stripper while my first wife was dying of cancer, and, you know, to tiny bit of self-exculpatory explanation here, I got involved with this girl before the wife got cancer, but that girl was so vile that she called the Jerry Springer Show and said, hey, how about we do a cancer love triangle special?
Oh, Jesus.
And one of the producers of the Jerry Springer Show said, well, how sick is Debbie? You know, can she get on a plane? That's a low point. I don't think I've ever sunk that low. And it was appalling to me. And yeah, I bear responsibility for being dumb enough to continue that, but that's more than anything I've ever done. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the Jerry Springer Show. Yeah. Well, can she get on a plane? That the only question was, is it feasible? Not should we do it.
Right. Can we get her rotting, you know, almost dead carcass on a plane to Chicago to film it? Right.
My God. Thomas, what are your thoughts on media figures in politics?
I think media figure in politics, that's not a red flag, but it's a pretty hefty yellow flag. I think they're going to always have problems because being a media figure, there's always a tendency, they're really, even though they're celebrities or looked up upon, they're really more followers than leaders. They're chasing clout. That's what they did for a lot of their life. And therefore, they're inherently more of a follower than a leader because they're just simply more prone to be trapped by the Overton window. I think a good example of this would be Arnold Schwarzenegger, who was this Terminator governor, but then he became a total alt-right cuck who's pro-mass immigration. So, you know, he probably, that might also have to do with like hormonal issues, he came off his, you know, perpetual roid rage maybe, and that does affect your political leanings. But, you know, he became part of the establishment because I think his whole life he trained to follow, you know, what was popular. And I think media personality, we can broadly construe that to also include podcasters. I'm pointing a finger at myself now, basically, but you see on the distant politics where there's too many people who have no outside experience from the movement who just podcast or whatever, and they're always chasing the next hot take. Well, they're following their kind of the opposite of the Overton window. They're trying to become more extreme, more radical. They got into office, how would they behave? Probably very terribly. But I don't think it's a hard and fast rule. For example, I wouldn't call him a media figure, but someone who definitely had a media presence was Lindbergh, Charles Lindbergh. He is famous both for his aviation stuff and for this terrible kidnapping case that was the crime of the century. But I think if he had become president, he would have made a very outstanding leader. That's a counterfactual, of course. And it kind of, and the exception almost proves the rule because he wasn't just a media pundit. His fame was based upon, you know, real life, non-media accomplishments in aviation. So ultimately, I think that they don't do well in politics, but there will be some very notable exceptions.
Well, let's hope that Tucker Carlson is one, because he is a media figure, and I would love to see him go into politics. Again, even if he wouldn't be the best politician that we can conceive of, I think he'd be a great political option to have out there. I think he could be a real bull in the China shop, which is something that I welcome. Again, you know, America needs a surgeon to deal with the cancer. It needs like a brain surgeon and a heart surgeon. It needs somebody with steady hands. And unfortunately, I don't think we're going to get anybody like that. And so this is why I look at somebody like Trump and just say, well, you know, we won't get the brain surgery that we need, but a bull in a China shop can really, you know, can change things too. But I would love to see Tucker run for office. And if he's in some kind of contract that keeps him from getting involved in media, I think he should just run for office, because that's an amazing opportunity. Now, of course, he has a family. He's got four kids. They might really not want that. He might have a lot of forces militating against that. But he's an example of somebody that I would certainly like to see try go into politics. I do think Trump is an example of a media figure, too. Of course, before he was in the media, he was a big businessman, you know, very much a self-promoting big businessman. Then he did his quote-unquote reality show, right? And then he went into politics. The media aspect of Trump and really the huckster aspect of Trump didn't serve him well as president, sadly. Made him a great candidate, but it didn't really make him a very effective president. So guys, I just want to check and see if there are any last questions here, because we've gone on for more than 2 hours. Time has flown because it's fun. I've been having a great time here. So let me check our friends at Entropy. Okay, Scott has written in with $10. Greg, I enjoyed your review of James Burnham book on Machiavellianism. If the aim of classical political philosophy is to define norms to guide society, isn't its greatest enemy naturalism? As a naturalist, how do you get past the fact-value distinction? Don't norms collapse into natural states? Okay, that's a good question. It's a big philosophical question. I'm just going to give a quick answer. I don't believe in the fact-value distinction. I think that norms are facts, that norms exist in nature, and that we have the capacity to discover them. For instance, I think there's a great analogy that can be made, and this is an analogy that's made in Plato, between medicine for the body and medicine for the soul, and morality is basically medicine for the soul. Now, is there a fact-value distinction in medicine? Is there just this vast gap between empirical fact and what medicine is trying to gain or restore, which is health? No. Health is an empirical fact. The difference between the healthy and the sick is a normative difference, if you will. It's a difference of functioning. We recognize that health is better than sickness. We recognize what are the marks of health. And doctors pursue cures to disease, and it's entirely factual and it's entirely evaluative at the same time. And I think that you can have a moral philosophy that's similarly fact-based. So that's my quick and dirty answer to that. But that's a big question. And thank you. I love the big philosophical questions. Let's see if there are any more questions or comments at Odyssey first.
Well, my quick two cents upon that, it's
sure.
My take is that norms arise from instincts in the blood, and it's something that you can scientifically, you know, observe. For example, you can say certain breeds of dogs have certain behavioral predispositions. Well, norms don't just come out of nowhere, even though everyone likes to say, oh, it's a social construct, act like that's a strong argument to tear it down. No, norms are usually cultural values, and those cultural values come from blood. And what different populations' instincts are is a fact. It's something that can almost scientifically be observed, you know, calculated. Like, for example, politeness, preferring space, or how much personal space you prefer, for example. That's actually kind of scientifically factual. Like if you're observing how, you know, do bees cluster together or keep their distance? Like in China, everyone's all clustered together. In Europe, we're more spread out. So I think norms are facts.
All righty, that's great. I have one last question. This is from Sutton, who is a longtime listener and reader. And he points out that today is Samuel Francis's birthday. We have a commemoration of Sam Francis up. And he just wants to know if any of us have any particular debts or thoughts to Sam Francis. I wrote about Sam Francis in the commemoration. Sam Francis was somebody who influenced my intellectual development in crucial ways. And he did it in small ways. He did it in columns that I would read. And I remember reading an obituary he wrote for John Connolly, who used to be the governor of Texas. He was in the car with JFK. He was wounded in the assassination. And Connolly was a different kind of conservative. And he explained the kind of conservative that Connolly was, as opposed to the kinds of conservatives that were dominant at the time. He did it in an 800-word obituary, and he crystallized the difference so effectively that I could no longer see the world in the same way. And I realized, oh my God, demographics is important. The cost-cutting labor, cheap labor lobby is inimical to the survival of our country. It all became crystal clear to me at that point. And at that point, I was sort of working my way out of being a libertarian. And so this was hugely influential. And years later, I had the opportunity to tell him about it. I don't even think he remembered the piece, but he was gratified that this little chip from his workbench, this little piece that he fired out there, you know, in his weekly or biweekly columns when he was working away as a very busy journalist, had a fundamental effect. He was an influence on my thinking. And then, of course, I read him for years before I actually met him in person. I met him in 2000. I was introduced to him at a Council of Conservative Citizens conference that I went to with Sam Dixon. And I was also introduced to Jared Taylor at the same time. And it was an important meeting. And I met him maybe on five occasions before his death. And I corresponded with him a little bit, but I didn't really spend a lot of time talking with him. But I was constantly reading his material for years. And yeah, he was a formative influence. Thomas, did you ever read Sam Francis? Is he in any way an important figure for you?
I have to unfortunately say no. I wish I knew more about him. He's one of the authors I do want to look into more, but I feel like he was kind of before my time, but that he made a lot of difference before my time and probably set up a lot of stuff that was foundations for stuff that did red pill me. So,
yeah, Jim, what about you?
As far as I know, he's the guy who invented the concept of anarcho-tyranny.
Absolutely, yeah.
So in that case, he was a prophet. But again, I'd like to go back to the previous question. If medical objective facts and medical values directly coincided, surgeons wouldn't be psychopaths, and there wouldn't be 100,000 iatrogenic deaths every year caused by medicine. So I don't think they're analogous at all.
Okay, well, this is to be continued. We could have a whole show on this. Folks, we've been on for 2 hours and almost 15 minutes, and I want to thank everybody. We've had great questions. I want to thank the questioners. I want to thank the donors. I want to thank Thomas. I want to thank Jim for coming on and helping out. I also want to thank moderators. They do a great job. And I want to thank all of you wonderful people out there who listen in. We will be back next week with another episode of Counterpoints Radio. Thank you.